Blog Talk Radio.
We have Fear of Suspense Radio. I am your host, John Robb, and I am pleased that you are all here to listen and join us. Whatever you do or wherever you're doing it from, we appreciate you being here with us again on this Saturday morning. Three great guests we got coming up today. First is going to be James Houston Turner, author of Greco's Game. Next, we're going to have Sarah Kernachan, which I'm sure she's going to tell me I screwed that one up. And her book is called Jane Was Here. And finishing it out is Amanda Kyle Williams, and she'll be talking about Stranger in the Room. So no point wasting any more time. Let's just get right to it, because 90 minutes of Suspense Radio starts right now. Welcome, everybody, for being here today. 90 Minutes of Suspense Radio is coming to you right now, and we are so thankful to welcome to the show our first guest of the show here, James Houston Turner, author of his latest book called Greco's Game, the second in his Alexander Polonov thriller series. So, James, thank you so much for coming on. How you doing?
I'm doing great, John. Good to be here.
And Greco's Game, like I just said, is book two now in your series of Alexander Polonov. Can you kind of give us a little behind the scenes of, you know, how the series kind of gone to progress and how Greco's Game is kind of folding out?
I used to be a smuggler behind the Iron Curtain, John, and those activities behind the Iron Curtain understandably landed me in trouble with the KGB. Well, there was a good guy agent in Moscow. I don't know who that person is. But he got wind of that, and he leaked word out of Moscow through a network of underground contacts that I was actually being followed in San Diego, where I was living at the time. So that is what gave me the idea of a good guy KGB agent, a spy in the KGB, as it were, working for us during the Cold War. So Telenov is inspired by that man and a dedication to that man for the risk he took to help me.
I mean, that's very interesting. And so, you know, when we're talking about the book here and how Polonov and the things kind of going through, what's kind of like the, you know, what's kind of like the reader going to understand, or what are they going to, when they pick up Greco's Game, you know, how are they going to know, you know, coming back here from the first book, you know, Department 13 until now, what's the main thing they might, you know, see that might be a little different, or how you kind of amp it up a little bit?
In Greco's Game, the title of that book comes from the very first recorded chess game played in 1619. Gioacchino Greco played against an unnamed opponent, and that game is famous for checkmate in only 8 moves by way of the queen's sacrifice. So the Russians love chess like we Americans do sports. You know, we always say What's your game plan? You know, we use sports metaphors. Well, the Russians study chess, and in fact, the KGB studied chess strategy. So in Greco's game, we have an assassination plot built around Greco's game. But the question is, of course, through the book, the mystery that propels that story along is, who is the target? Because right up front, Telemach's wife is killed, and he assumes the bullet was meant for him. Is it? That's the question that no one can answer as we go through the book, as to who was really the target with that assassination bullet.
You know, and the character that's also in here, Larissa, you know, she's a hooker, Los Angeles, so she's kind of, you know, one of those characters that's not only mysterious, but you know that she has some kind of backstory in order to, you know, kind of get herself kind of in the line of work, I guess you want to say, and into, you know, the darker side of life, basically. You know, what's her story? You know, what exactly is the reader going to kind of get at and to know a little bit more about Larissa as they kind of go along?
Well, just a quick background here. You know, as when the Soviet Union dissolved and the Berlin Wall came down and that whole world changed, the KGB was dissolved, basically. And so I have Telemach retired, living in Australia, but in Greco's game, he's now living in Los Angeles. But many of his old KGB buddies went to work for the Russian mafia. So old comrades are now enemies. And so Telemach comes up against and, in fact, tackles a human trafficking operation being run by some of his old KGB colleagues. So Larissa is one of the victims of this human trafficking ring. And incidentally, human trafficking is more profitable for organized crime than arms trafficking. So there's more money in trafficking people, sending them into slavery, than there is in marketing weapons. And, of course, Larissa is caught up in that, and she targets Telemach in a nightclub. The question is why? Why? What's going on with that? And as the more Telemach becomes swept up in this deadly plot, the more he begins to understand Larissa's role in all this and how she's been manipulated by an organization that's a lot greater and more sinister than anyone realizes.
And I want to remind everybody here that we're speaking with author James Houston Turner, and it's jameshoustonturner.com is the website where you can find out here now more about Greco's Game and the first novel, Department 13. But When you kind of go on, the funny thing that I see here is one of the things that we're going to go back to Identity Factor, which was your first thriller book, and one of the comments that came out to me is because I love villains and I always think that villains make the book, and I know the hero is, you know, kind of how the story progresses and this and that, but without a great villain, it doesn't really make the hero that either much supernatural or that intriguing. And one of the lines in the praises was, they said that they love a great villain, and great villains demand great heroes, and that's one of the things that was in, you know, the Identity Factor. Is that one of your focuses, that when you start to write, that you put a lot of thought into those kinds of villains because of the expansion that it makes your hero?
Yeah, you know, and that's a good point, John. I mean, and I do. You're right. I do. I want to create something that brings outrage to the reader. You know, the greater the villain, the greater the hero. And that is what I try to do, is I try to write from something that stirs me. A phrase I like to use is, you know, follow the fire. You know, what's the passion inside me? Either something that really inspires me or something that outrages me. And human trafficking is one of those. And in the Identity Factor, it's the senseless killing that goes on in the name of religion sometimes. So everybody warring against one another. And when Adani Marapas, the actor who played Abu Fayed in season 6 of the TV series 24, he and I become mates, and he made that comment. He's gracious enough to give me that comment because he was the villain everybody loved to hate. So he hit the nail head on there, that I love a great villain, and that takes work. You know, how do you construct somebody that's so despicable, and yet on the surface is so smooth, you know, the old wolf in sheep's clothing, as it were. So you're right, John. I really try to work at creating a top villain, because then our hero or heroine has to rise to that challenge.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that are in a thriller series, that you kind of have to keep the pace extremely quick as you go through, and being able to have a great villain and a great emotional pull from the readers, when they email you to say, God, I hate that character because it just kind of scared me so much, or just because I wanted him to die earlier, or something to that effect, that's got to make you feel good, because you're like, good, I did my job. Good, you hated him. That was the whole idea.
Yeah, you're right, you know, and in Greco's game, I deal with some raw emotional material a bit, and a couple of people wrote and said, wow, that was a bit too real, and I guess I want people to feel a little uncomfortable at times, because if we gloss over some of these injustices, we kind of come away thinking they're no real big deal, and they are. I mean, there are people who get caught up in that, and while I didn't want to, this is no documentary, certainly, and I don't want to make people really uncomfortable, I wanted to just kind of a little pinprick of, wow, I didn't realize that, to kind of bring that point home. So that's what I tried to do in Greco's game, was provide some of that emotion, something that touches the heart and makes people feel with Larissa or feel with Talonoff as he's taking on these challenges, that this is something serious and worthwhile.
Yeah, and when you're talking like the human trafficking, the one thing that kind of comes to mind is, now, of course, we've seen little snippets of people who watched Law and Order and this and that, but the movie Taken that Liam Neeson did was all about that, when his daughter was kidnapped and people might have saw that kind of darker side. Did you have to kind of go any kind of underground, or how did you, you know, kind of be able to research that? Because it is such a very dark, I mean, it's one of the, you got to say, it's got to be one of the worst things that is out there. I mean, aside from, you know, even worse than, you know, drugs and things like that. I mean, human trafficking, I mean, I just can't think of really anything worse.
You're right, and I had the privilege of being a journalist at the Union Rescue Mission in Los Angeles. It's the largest street mission in the world at one time, and I interviewed some of the victims of human trafficking at a women's shelter that was run by the mission, and I was actually able to go into this women's shelter and talk to them and hear their stories and anguish with them of what it's like to live on the streets. Now, that was some years back, and so when I got the idea, I was actually on a Qantas flight from Sydney, to Los Angeles, and the whole idea of Greco's game sort of came together. So I knew I had to update some of that research, and I was able to contact a Ukrainian journalist, Marina Sandul, and she and I worked to really develop Larissa's character. And Irina had written on human trafficking, and she's very knowledgeable in that area. So we worked together. I brought in some of the information and the interviews that I had from my journalist past, and was able to then create Larissa's character to try and bring an authenticity to her of what it's like to be with that a nice East European or Ukrainian personality who gets swept up in something. Her family's in danger. She's trapped. She feels no way out. She has a debt that she can't pay. And along comes somebody that says, you know, look, you may not, we need to work and fight, and it's worth the fight. And so they do. They, Talonoff and Larissa form this alliance to begin unraveling the mystery of who killed his wife and who's behind all of this, this kind of conspiracy against Talonoff.
Now, to kind of give the audience a little bit more roundedness of exactly who James Houston Turner is, we kind of have to go back to a book that you wrote, which I don't know if a lot of people remember this, because when they go on your website and they kind of click on your name and it says James, they're able to see your bio. First, they're going to see what, like, 1970s and 1980s style that I can remember photos, but they're going to know here, you know, I love the hairdo and the mustache. I love it all with, you know, when you're on there with Regis and Cindy. But you are considered the Spud Man for your book, 101 Ways to Cook Potatoes, the Spud Book. Now, are you going to bring out a sequel to that one? are you going to amp that to 202 ways?
Oh, well, I you did more digging than I thought you were going to do, mate. I tell
oh,
you what.
Baby, I dig hard.
You don't play fair. Yeah, I got my start as Spud Man. I had an apron with a big potato on it. I was about 50 pounds heavier, incidentally, so I did find certain advantages to fiction. It's far less fattening than potatoes, but yeah, I did. I got sent coast to coast by French's Foods. They wanted somebody to use their product. I got to wave their product with one hand, wave my book with the other, and it got on with Regis and with Pat Boone, and did. I was one of America's first TV cooks, and
yep.
My wife and I still, we have a little shoebox kitchen in Adelaide, South Australia, where we live, and we get in there and we just cook up a storm, but that's how I got my start. I really do owe my my career to the Spud book, because it taught me a lot about promotion. It taught me a lot about readers and what they love and how to interact with the public, and I got some media training, and it was a great, great experience. But as my mom said, it's kind of a chicken today, feathers tomorrow kind of living, because I was actually asked to bring out a sequel called The Bean Book, 101 Ways to Fix Beans, but I was doing my, I know, there's all kinds of things you can go where you can go with that one, but I...
Does that come with a bottle of Lysol with every purchase?
Oh, man, so anyway, here I am in fiction, you know, and that was because of my smuggling work behind the Iron Curtain, is the people and places that I experienced that led to that. But you're right, you did your homework, I can tell.
Yeah, and you brought up a fabulous point that you might never even realize that you brought up, as you said, that got me to understand marketing, and no greater thing today, like yourself, as you see how the publishing business has changed so much that now you're able to kind of go back to capitalize on what you learned back then, to not be able to be behind the times like so many authors are now because they never had to do it. You have that step up, and you got to feel that has helped you now along the way. Even though things have changed, you're already ahead of the game.
Well, you know, the old saying goes that good decisions come from wisdom. Wisdom comes from mistakes, and mistakes come from bad decisions. So really, good decisions come from bad decisions. There's a genuine, legitimate connection there, and I've made a lot of mistakes. I know what doesn't work, and I've done a lot of it. So what I find today in promotion in particular is the best way to promote is to not promote. And because there's so much, I mean, I see seminars all the time, how to turn Facebook into your marketing platform, and how to use Twitter to sell your book. And I'm going, you know, when I get all of these pitches flowing into my inbox, I just delete, 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 because no one wants to be sold. I mean, people love to buy, but people hate to be sold. And so I don't sell. I don't push myself on anybody. And yet I spoke on my book tour last year to several thousand public school kids about not letting the hard knocks of life defeat you, because I've come through cancer. I was once given 18 months to live. I survived that. I've survived editors and agents. I was told when I first tried to market Department 13, which is book number one, as you said, in the Tylenol series, I was turned down by every single agent and editor I sent a letter to, every single one. They said, hey, no one's going to want to read about a middle-aged, retired KGB agent, a Russian, who's over the hill, who's a dinosaur. No one wants that. Write something else. Well, guess what? Most of those agents are now out of work, and guess who's still going strong? Tylenol.
Yep.
And that book went on to win the USA News Best Thriller of 2011. It won gold medals in the 2012 IFPI Book Awards and gold medal in the Indie Book Awards. So a lot of those so-called experts don't know as much as they think they do. So I say to people, don't give up. Write what stirs you, what your passion is, because there's always room for a good book. So I've stuck with my guns, but it's taken over a decade to get here, so it's not always an easy road.
And I want to remind everybody here that we are speaking with author James Houston Turner, and it's jameshoustonturner.com is his website. The book is number two right now in his series called Greco's Game, for it is book two in the Alexander Talonov thriller series. So now, when you came out with Identity Factor and then you kind of went on to Department 13, did you kind of have an idea that you wanted this to be a series? Was that what you were doing it? Did you sell it that way as a series? Is that kind of how it started coming about?
Yes. I mean, I after Department 13, I had a lot of people going, okay, what's next?
Yeah.
And so I thought, what is next? And that is, it was the response, the enthusiasm to Department 13 that really motivated me to do a second book that was Greco's game and into a whole series. He resonated with people, and I like him. I mean, he's flawed like I'm flawed, and I guess because I've made so many mistakes along the way, that's why I have him making mistakes and struggling with certain things. So, yes, I really look forward to this series. And in the next book, Dragonhead, which will be book number 3, I wanted to surprise readers even more. And so what I've done is I've brought in 3 orphan teenage characters who were, in fact, victims of human trafficking. I want to continue dealing with that and have Talonov tackle that. But these 3 teenagers who were orphans on the street of Philadelphia, and Talonov then meets in South Africa, sort of adopt him against his will. And Talonov is known as the Iceman. He never lets anybody get close. That caused problems in his marriage in the first book and continues to. Well, all of a sudden, these teenagers come in, and they just won't let him go. They're as tough as he is, but in a different dimension. So his life gets turned upside down again with these teenagers. But they know things that he doesn't. You know, he doesn't know the technology that students and young people do today. And so it fits together like the proverbial hand and glove, and they become a crime-fighting team of Talonov and these 3 kids. So that's kind of a new direction that readers have to look forward to in the next book.
Now, when you're kind of out and about, because it looks like that you're doing, you know, quite a bit of events out there for your book, and when people come up to you and they might not know who you are and they're like, oh, you know, what is this? And you're like, oh, this is book 2 in my series. Do they get the sense that you tell them you can start with this? Should they go back and read the first one? What exactly, do you tell them that they should do?
Well, I try to make each story a standalone story. Greco's Game is a story in its own right. It helps if you've read Department 13. Department 13 gives you a bit of background on, in fact, the book opens in this secret meeting in 1983, so you get a sense of what Talonov is like in his KGB years. But then the story fast forwards to modern-day Australia, and that story takes place. Greco's Game is not a sequel in a technical sense, in that it's not an episodic book where it continues on where Department 13 leaves off. It's a standalone, but they are loosely connected, and that's what I want is for people. Then you can start with Greco's Game, and you may go, wow, I want to know what happened before that. You can read Department 13, and in fact, in Greco's Game, I make an anecdotal comment where Talonov once had to shoot a woman in Spain who was trying to kill him. So there's going to be a little story about the woman in Spain. There's going to be Dragonhead, and then there's probably right now, mentally, I'm outlining and working on another 3 stories in addition to that. So there's about another 6 stories in the Talonov series that are planned. So there's a lot of good reading ahead, but each book is standalone, and you can pick up anywhere in that series and enjoy those stories.
Yeah, and I think that's always important, and I'm sure that's always questions that you do get. People are always wondering, you know, well, what the heck's going on? Do I have to go back and read the first one? Do I have to do the thing? And I think it's great that when you write a series, it's like, no, you can start with this one. You want to go back, go ahead and go back, but you don't have to actually start at the beginning, which I think turns a lot of people on, that they don't have to kind of do that, because I think a lot of people feel like, oh, well, I'm already 5 books in, and I don't want to start a new series. So I think that that's, you know, fabulous.
Yeah, well, thanks, mate. That's what I've tried to do, and it's like you said, it's just make each one that can start anywhere and enjoy that story on its own.
So you have no plans to do any standalone right now. We're looking at Talonov down the line for the next couple of, looks like, sounds like 3-4 years, right?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, there's characters from the Identity Factor that are pretty cool as well, but right now I don't have any direct plans to continue those characters on, although in the future I could pick that up.
Well, James, we want to thank you so much for joining us today. I mean, we ran out of time. I mean, this was like a fabulous interview. We want to thank you so much for coming on, and I want to remind everybody your website, jameshoustonturner.com. The book is Greco Game. His first book is the Spud Book. Get them all. Eat some potatoes. Read some books. It's a great thing to do. So, James, thanks so much for coming on.
Oh, the privilege is mine, John. I look forward to talking with you again and seeing you soon. Take care, mate.
Absolutely. You enjoy.
Will do. Bye-bye.
All right, bye. So, again, everybody, that's author James Houston Turner, an incredible story that we did have a chance to get into that you can find out about when you go to his website and click James to see more about him. You will see his story going all the way from the beginning to the end. I mean, it's just an incredible story. Like I said, it was something that you really didn't get into except the Spud book. But his book is Greco's Game, another exciting thriller series set, fast-paced, great characters, great villains, and this is always, what I always find very important. So definitely one that you want to check out. We're going to be back on here with our next guest coming up. That is Sarah Kernachan. And I think she's going to probably correct me again with her last name, but we'll see. Maybe I got it right, but I seriously doubt it because I suck at this. So we will see you back here in just a few minutes. Instead, enjoy this. New music today, too, just so you know. See if you recognize it. Welcome back, everybody, here. If you didn't recognize that, that was Beat It, but it was not Michael Jackson singing, because there was no singing. That was from John 5, if you're curious. So we, again, want to thank James Houston Turner for being on the show, and we are going to come right now into our next guest, her author, and I told you I would mess it up, so she told me I was right. Sarah Kernikan is who we have on the show. Her book is called Jane Was Here. You can go to her website. It's Sarah, last name is spelled K-E-R-N-O-C-H-A-N. So, Sarah, thank you so much for coming on, and how are you doing?
I'm doing well. I don't think your listeners are going to have are going to be able to reconstruct my name from spelling it either, but anyway.
Hey, but at least when they go and then they type it in and they want to go to Google, and they want, at least they know that they're spelling it, that it gets the right, to the right site and, instead of someplace else. But
yeah,
that's all,
it's,
you know,
best
that's all important.
It's best to just remember the name of the book, which is Jane Was Here.
Right. And that's pretty good, because it's not a hard title to remember, but it's an extremely, you know, it's one of those books that, you know, when you're reading it, and when you're, you know, even seeing the synopsis of it, it's the one that, it's one that'll stick in your mind. So can you tell everybody a little bit about the book, behind the scenes, the, you know, characters, the whole nine yards?
Well, I characterize it as a reincarnation thriller, in that there is a present day cast of characters who are on the verge of an enormous collision, and then there is the story 150 years ago, the people that they once were in another lifetime. So the mystery and the suspense is in connecting the two lifetimes. You don't have to be a believer in reincarnation. It's just a great puzzle, you know, with a cataclysmic ending. It came to me, I think most writers will say that their ideas came to them seemingly out of the blue, and this happens to me a lot, but the ideas come in very different forms, which is probably why I'll never write a series. I am primarily known as a screenwriter, but I also write, you know, music and books. So ideas come to me in various forms. I've made documentaries as well. But primarily as a screenwriter, I'm usually, you know, writing for that medium. And this image came to me, which I carried around a long time and tried to use in various scripts, but which didn't work out. And it was simply this. It was that an ordinary housewife kind of woman would be chopping vegetables at a cutting board and look down and see that her hands are covered with blood. And when she goes to wash them off, there is no cut. There is nothing that caused the blood. And together with the idea, I thought possibly this person who is guilty of nothing in this lifetime had in another lifetime murdered somebody and hidden the body and, you know, got away with it. And, you know, it was going to be her quest to find herself back then, to find the grave of the person that she killed. That isn't, in fact, how I used that image when I finally got around to doing it successfully in Jane Was Here, although that scene takes place. But I realized I could make that image work by presenting the story from the point of view of the victim. In other words, the victim, who is Jane, of Jane Was Here, wanders into a town. You know, she's a peculiar young woman, and she insists that she was raised here because she has a memory of it, but she can't really explain why she feels that way. The minute she enters this little New England town, everything starts to change, you know, and other people start having strange memories or hallucinations. In other words, all the people who were involved in killing this woman 150 years ago,
yeah,
are starting to remember just enough to make them extremely unaccountably anxious. And we follow her as she puts together, you know, what the story is behind her demise, because she is the only one among them who believes that she is the reincarnation of a woman who had disappeared in this same town. So you know, the puzzle that I constructed is the same that she has to unravel. And in a way, you know, it is a puzzle of karma itself. You know, it is a story of divine justice, because in the end, you know, by the end, everyone in this lifetime who was involved in the crime back then will have paid.
And one of the credits that a lot of people, and of course, I think it's one of the very underrated movie. I don't know if it got a lot of press. I thought it was fabulous. And when you're talking about it, it almost kind of brings up to your head is the movie that you helped screenwrite, which is What Lies Beneath, and that was with Michelle Pfeiffer and Harrison Ford.
Yeah,
and
that's
so,
had an.
And when people kind of know that story, they're going to kind of have an understanding of what you're writing and what your ideas kind of are like. And I'll tell you, it was thrilling. I love the movie, and the book is just kind of like, you know, that same kind of progression as people go through.
Yes, it's actually not a genre that I'm known for. In fact, I'm not really known for any genre in particular. As I said, I really bounce around, and you can see that my screen credits...
Well, you should stick with this one, because you're good with this one.
My screen credits are very eclectic.
They are, because it goes all the way to Summers, me too, which has nothing to do with, you know, killing and thrills.
I know, and well, actually, there is a murder in it, but, I mean, nine and a half weeks is as good as you can get.
And I was going to ask you, which scene did you help write on that one?
Because
we all know there's one very important scene in that movie that people have seen it. you know, it's probably a little different than a Suspense Radio talk, but it is interesting talk nevertheless.
Well, I wrote the refrigerator scene. How's that?
Nice. There we go. So, okay.
But there's very little dialogue in it.
Very little dialogue.
Yeah.
But, you know,
anyway,
about your book. Yeah, you set it in the perfect area because, you know, when you set things like in small New England, it has the most history that you can have in the United States, and that's the perfect place to put this.
Yes, Jane was here, I the past lifetime, 150 years ago. I set it in a time, 1853, that's pre-Civil War, when there are all of these... cult experiments going on, like transcendentalism and the Shakers. You know, there was a whole trend towards utopian society. And in the past life, this guy comes through town and engages the affections of the heroine, and he's involved in some religious cult that is locating to Massachusetts and about to be kicked out. Which believes that you can become an angel within your lifetime if you kind of follow the prescription. And it is an example of some of these nutty ideas that completely obsessed, you know, some people at the time, and they were willing to go off and in these arcane communities and sometimes leave very little trace of themselves behind, you know, that they would, you know, just disperse. But this is kind of the catalytic event that happens to the heroine Jane back then. There are two Janes. There's Jane of the present and Jane of the past.
And I want to remind everybody, we're speaking here with author Sarah Kerchikan, and the book is Jane Was Here. And, you know, you can also go to the website janewashere.com for a little bit more in-depth information also that you have going on there. And a lot of and when you're sitting here and you're very good and, you know, at writing, you know, extremely strong female characters. And so when you're writing a character like that and you're sitting down and you're thinking about it, how much thought goes into kind of the evolution of, you know, the backstory and the whole part of her character when you start to, you know, go through the progression of getting the novel written?
Well, this particular one, because it involved the past and the present, I had to sit down and figure out the story of the past first, because that actually governed, you know, who each character would be in the present. In other words, you know, if you had drowned in 1853, you might come back as someone who is deathly afraid of the water without knowing why, kind of like Natalie
right.
Wood was always, you know, unaccountably afraid of water.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm always asking, well, what if this particular trait came from a past life? And so I did do the past lives first, and then I constructed lives for my new characters, which would reflect, you know, their karma for what they'd done in the past. And it's not that easy to trace, you know, it's not an exact match, you know, because a man can come back as a woman, you know, an old man can come, you know, is now seen as a child or, you know, that, or can be black in one lifetime and white in the other, you know, and you have to connect these somehow by figuring out what is the resonance between one life and the other. And I had to go through that myself in order to construct it. But the other element that I depend upon is my own notion of the paranormal, because this is technically a paranormal thriller. And that brings me back to the subject of what lies beneath.
Uh-huh.
That is a ghost story, and this one is not quite a ghost story, although in a way it is. But I that was a script that I originally wrote for Steven Spielberg,
uh-huh.
and it eventually passed into the hands of Bob Zemeckis, who brought in his own writer. So, you know, only about half of that is my script, as it turns out. But I got hired by Spielberg because an executive in his company said, I know who's the perfect person for this, because she had a ghost in her past. She's actually had experiences with ghosts. And Stephen got all excited about that because he's always wanted to have an experience of that kind. He's always wanted to contact the other side. He himself actually did a movie about reincarnation. So he's fascinated with that stuff. So my initial interview with him, I just told him a few of the things that had happened to me, and he got all excited and jealous, and I did get the job. But my version of the script was actually, he wanted something more like Close Encounters of the Third Kind, in that he wanted to have the audience have a very real experience, you know, not necessarily, you know, with chains clanking, or, you know, it wasn't necessarily supposed to be a scary movie, but certainly a movie that was full of awe and wonder. So, you know, that was my first experience in constructing a past life for the person who's coming back as a ghost. So you definitely have to do the past and the backstory, but in a different century, you know, than
yeah.
you do. And then Zemeckis changed the ghost to having been recently died, and that was a huge change. Anyway, it's sort of interesting how, you know, the genesis of those projects. But as I said, my script had been quite different and based in some part on my own experiences.
See, this is a reason why we do the show and bring on authors like yourself, is because from just sitting here listening, and the audience hopefully will get the same ideas that I have, is that you have such attention to detail when you're writing your book, and that's something that a new author does not quite have yet. And that's why when they read a book like Jane Was Here, that they're going to see that there's that attention to detail. There's not kind of those loose ends. There's not those things where people are questioning, because you've thought about it. You've thought it out. And as a fully polished, professional, you know, just fabulous thriller, suspense thriller, that when they read, and that's difficult in today's day and age for consumers when they go out to buy books, they're like, well, what do I get? You know, they're not really sure what they're getting. And that's why when, you know, we have authors like yourself on, it's just so refreshing to hear that attention to detail and those things that you write about, and how close you think, just a little nuances of like, well, how are they actually going to be when they get, are they going to be afraid of certain things because of how they died, and is that going to be a clue? And that's just what I find absolutely fascinating.
Well, thank you, you know, for your compliment on my
yeah.
style. But, you know, I always wanted to write a book, and I had actually published one back in the 70s. I guess I just dated myself.
Right. But, I saw that one. I wasn't going to do that to you, because I know one thing you never do is you never ask a woman's weight or age, and I wasn't going to date you. But now that you've opened the door, we could talk about that book back in 1977, I believe. And it was called The Dry Hustle. So go ahead.
Well, I swear I'm going to connect it up to the original topic that you brought up,
yeah.
But it's just another example of my checkered career, you know, my very diverse choice of subjects. But Dry Hustle was about a pair of con women who travel across the country working a con called the Dry Hustle. And mainly what they do is they get, you know, they seduce men into thinking that the men think they're going to get free sex, you know. And so they give the women money for, you know, because they tell them this story or that story. And then the women never show up when the tryst is supposed to happen. So in other words, you never pretend to be a prostitute, because that puts the men's, you know, sexual expectations on a whole other level and makes it more like business. This is kind of a personal, you know, wangling your way into a man's psyche, you know, so that he gets all excited about what's about to happen and not paying much attention to how, you know, the amounts of money that he's laying out on you. And then at the time when he thinks that he's finally going to get it, you simply aren't there. You know, you're on to the next town. So this subject kind of chose me, and not the other way around, because I met these women in a dance hall, actually, in Times Square. And don't ask me what I was doing there, but they were, you know, working this con, and after I befriended them, they kind of showed their hand to me and, you know, told me what they were doing, and I immediately knew I had a book. So I went off and traveled with them and kind of learned how to do what they were doing, sort of gonzo style, and then wrote a novel based on it. You know, the main character was, in fact, very thinly disguised. Version of the woman who taught me the ropes, basically,
mm-hmm.
who was an incredibly colorful character. So that was my book back then. And I, you know, some 30 years went between the first book and the second book because I became very embroiled in making money, which meant that I was...
How dare you?
Yeah. I was writing movies. You know, I had a
right.
substantial screenwriting career going on, but, you know, my most heartfelt desire from the time that I was 14 was to be a writer of novels, and I always wanted to go back to it, and I worried a great deal that my writing was being ruined by screenwriting, you know, because it's a whole other kind of writing. You know, you're talking about my attention to detail and the literariness of my book, and believe me, that is not how you write scripts. So, you know, they're very casual. They're very
mm-hmm.
casual, and you know, you can get literary in places, but basically you want to keep things moving and keep, you know, mainly to keep the reader under the impression that they're watching a movie. So sometimes you don't even write in complete sentences, and you write as little description as possible.
Right.
You know, and a lot of the page is taken up by dialogue. When I finally sat down to write Jane Was Here, I was surprised to find that my voice not only returned, but was much better. I mean, it was great to be able to use vocabulary for once. You know, and I had a pretty big vocabulary, but I was never able to really use it in scripts because my agent would say, please take that word out. They're not going to know what that means. You know, a word like obdurate. You know, I love that word, but you know, it belongs in a book. You know, not in a script. So you know, all my frustrations were gone in that I could use all of these tools that I'd had from the beginning. And that had been kind of in abeyance, but I found that my writing had actually improved. because I was much more economical, and you do have to be do that, you know. You can't be very indulgent stylistically at all. And you also are revising constantly, you know, usually because other people tell you to. You know, you don't own a script, and it's constantly changing because other people are involved with it or they own it. And they have the right to tell you to change stuff. But that actually made me, you know, a very calm and merciless editor of my own stuff. And the other way that it really improved me was because I learned plot. And I don't know of what creative writing, you know, in speaking of fiction, prose, classes teach you plot. They just don't. You know, it's considered like, you know, not that necessary. It's just not discussed. And
no, I think they just kind of mention it and kind of leave it to you to figure out what that's going to be, but not really how to construct one. It's just about this is how your writing should be, but not necessarily like, well, how do you write to construct, which I think is something that gets missed.
Yeah, and yet that's all you find in a class on screenwriting. You know, where it's down to a formula, you know, the inciting event, and then the hero does this and that. You know, I mean, mostly writers go to Joseph Campbell, you know, for the hero's journey and things like that, if they've got any guide at all. But the teachers themselves often don't know how to really construct a plot. So when it came to Jane Was Here, you know, I'm proud that when you read Jane Was Here, you feel like you're watching a movie. And yet there's a great deal of literary detail. But the construction of it very much, you know, is satisfying in the way that a movie is satisfying. You know, it's constantly moving. You have to really pay attention to what's happening on the screen, you know, this detail, that detail, you know. And there is a structure to it, you know, that is something that you may not be aware of, but that is in place and is moving.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to remind everybody again that we are speaking here with author Sarah Kernikan. And the book is called Jane Was Here. You can go to janewashere.com to find out a lot more about the book. So real quick here, another question is, what character in the book, Jane Was Here, was like a surprising character, one that when you started working with and you started writing about, you didn't realize would have that big of an impact as it did when the book was finished?
Oh, well, that's easy, because I did a whole version of the book first, with Jane being quite a different person. In that version, Jane was a character who remembered everything about the previous life, and she's here to take her revenge. And when I completely rewrote it, I made her a person who was completely innocent of that knowledge, and who was just trying to piece together these weird memories, you know, and flashbacks that she has. So that character was completely reconstructed, and it was a total surprise to me. But the reaction that I got from my agents and my editor, you know, convinced me that I was on the wrong track the first time. So, as I said, I'm a fairly merciless editor of my own work, and that became you know, I didn't even argue it. You know, I just immediately went into, you know, to rewrite mode.
And what now is the future going to be holding? What are your fans going to see? We know you're not going to be doing a series, so are you already starting to construct like your next kind of standalone that's going to come out? Is it going to be next year in 2013? What are we going to see?
Well, if listeners can find their way to my blog somehow, which is just, you know...
Is it hidden? Is it What Lies Beneath someplace?
It's called At Home with a Ghost, and it is the story of my involvement with a family ghost and how that led to a lot of paranormal experiences of a more expansive nature than just the one ghost. And it's unrolling in serial form and as blog posts on my blog. It's up to I guess about 150 pages now, but you know,
wow.
you can start anywhere. You know, you can start in the current chapter, or you can go back to the beginning. You can come in at any time, but if you're curious, you can also go back. And that's really gathering followers now, because it is a bit of a page turner, and my agent feels that it is my next book, although I started it really for personal cathartic reasons.
So then, that's something that, so fans then that already know you, or people now that are listening to you, they're able to kind of understand, and when they see the book coming out, they'll have a lot more familiarity with it because you're putting it on your blog. Well, I'll tell you what, Sarah, we want to thank you so much for coming on to talk a lot about the book, Jane Was Here, and a lot of the other things, you know, in your past. It was fascinating, and we just want to thank you so much, and we'd love to have you back on when the next book comes out. That would be great.
Thank you, John. It's been a pleasure.
All right. You have a great day, and we will talk with you later.
Okay. Take care.
Bye-bye. So, again, everybody, that was author Sarah Kernikan, and the website is Jane Was Here. You can go there and find out more about the book, Jane Was Here. And like she said, if you can, you know, find her blog, go to her main site, sarahkernikan.com, K-E-R-N-O-C-H-A-N. We are going to take another quick break, and then we are going to come back here with our last guest to round out the show, and that is none other than author Amanda Kyle Williams with the book Stranger in the Room. Sometimes I feel that way already, that there's always someone in the room with me. So we'll be right back, and in the meantime, you can listen to, well, let me find something. I don't even know what to listen to. So let's just put this on, and we'll see what you think.
Thank you.
So again, everybody, we want to thank you so much for staying with us today, because we have had a fabulous show. We are down here now to our last guest. She is the author of the, well, her character, I guess you want to say, you call it more of the Stranger series just because there's Stranger in the title, but her character is Key Street. And the latest book in the series is Stranger in the Room. And we want to welcome Amanda Kyle Williams here to the show. So, Amanda, thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's such an honor to be here. I've been listening to the program. It's fabulous.
Oh, wow, an honor. See, we don't get that a lot. Not a lot of people think it's an honor to talk to me. They think it's like a poison. So, hey, but here we go. So the second book in the series, the first one was The Stranger You Seek. Now we got The Stranger in the Room, the second book here in your K Street series. We put your trailer up online. I know we had it up on our website for a while. It was a great trailer. Tell everybody a little bit about Stranger in the Room, kind of how Key's kind of progressed now from the first book to the second, and a little behind-the-scenes stuff.
Yeah, sure. And it was a very creepy trailer, wasn't it? That's from the Twisted Minds at Random House Marketing. I love them. Well, when we first met Key Street in the first book, Stranger You Seek, we knew that she had been fired from the FBI, that she had been divorced, that she had been through a rehab to try to manage the addiction that derailed her career and her life. She had returned to Atlanta, where she's from. Key is an American Chinese who was raised by white Southern parents, so she's deeply Southern and is passionate about the South where she lives. The series is set in Atlanta, Georgia. And she's returned to kind of apply the skills that she learned at the FBI, 4 years in the field, 4 years in the behavioral analysis unit, to making a living. I mean, you got to keep the lights on, right? So she's doing what she has to do to do that, which includes some process serving and bail recovery and typical private detective work. And she's also kind of wiggled back in the back door of law enforcement as a consultant because she specializes in profiling violent repeat offenders. So she'll never be welcomed back officially because of her shady past, but she's now able to consult with local law enforcement. So in the first book, it was all about hunting down this killer, the press name nickname Wishbone, because this killer had a tendency to want to write taunting letters to the press and to the local law enforcement about interaction with a victim. And in one of the letters, the killer wrote, the last sound she heard above her own whimper was the crack of her neck, like a wishbone snapped in half. And thus the nickname Wishbone, and then the chase is on. And in the second book, Stranger in the Room, and by the way, Stranger will, it is the Stranger series, Stranger will appear in all the titles.
Good.
We find Key kind of doing all the things she has to do again to keep the lights on. She's dealing with a particularly nasty bail jumper who wants to transfer his DNA, and I'll leave it at that. She's also been hired to investigate a crooked crematory operation. Bodies are going in, but they don't appear to be being cremated. So she's trying to unravel that. At the same time, her first cousin, who has a history of mental illness and drug and alcohol abuse, is claiming that she's being stalked. And he's a little slow to get on board with this because she doesn't know if her cousin Mickey is just embroiled in another drama. And but indeed, she finds out that there's a very dangerous guy after her cousin. And at the same time, I like to keep my PI busy. She's consulting with local law enforcement, Atlanta Homicide, on the case of a young athlete and an elderly gentleman being murdered.
You know, it takes a different kind of, you know, when people say that are they dealing with the right side of the brain or the left side of the brain, the one thing that intrigued me that kind of stuck out, of course, was the idea of going into a crematorium where the bodies are something else is happening. Now, how the hell did you think of that one? Because I got to tell you, I have never heard of anybody going into a mystery where they're like, well, let's go to a crematorium. Well, it's like, what the heck else could you possibly be doing with the bodies? Now, I don't want to know, maybe, but I just think that it's interesting. So you got to say, I mean, how did that one come about?
Well, yeah, and I'd like to tell you a little bit more about that, but it would.
I know,
it would
but
be
it's going to give away. It's going to give away. Don't
yeah,
worry, no one's listening. It's just you and me. Go ahead. We'll do it off the air. Okay, now we're off the air. So go ahead.
Right. It would be a big old spoiler, but I can say that we had a case here in Georgia in 2002 where a crematory was in fact not cremating the bodies. And, you know, at that time, I thought that every crime writer in the region, that the bells must be going off, because it did for me as soon as I heard this story.
Yeah.
And I have consultants with the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, so I was able to get the original scene photographs when they arrived at the scene and go visit the property. Now, I made it a very different story, and in fact, the it's much more sinister in my book, and it is a different story. But it was definitely inspired by this crematory that wasn't cremating bodies. In fact, when the GBI arrived, they found 333 uncremated bodies in the lake, in the woods, in vaults, in the garage, piled up. It was unreal. I mean, just looking at the photographs, it's like. It's like looking at something from Halloween. It's like theatrical latex. It's so grotesque. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, what the heck were they putting in the urns, for crying out loud? Were they burning wood?
Yeah.
I don't understand the purpose of not burning the body.
Yeah, they were putting cement mix in the urns.
Well, I guess no one really looks at the urn, do they, to see if it's, you know, yeah, that's George. I mean, I guess no one really knows.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And apparently, now I'm no expert on cremains, but apparently cement mix very much does resemble pulverized bone fragments, which is what cremains actually are. So that story very much inspired part of the story in Stranger in the Room. And this guy, in the real life story, this guy is now in jail, and I think no one is really still quite sure what the motivation was there. I think there's some theory that something broke maybe in the crematory and he just never wanted to fix it.
Yeah, I mean, because I guess it would be kind of bad if you had, like, cement mix in there and then all of a sudden you accidentally open it, a little bit of water gets in, and then George becomes a rock. I mean, I guess that's a way of reincarnation, but I just don't get it. Interesting.
Yeah, very.
So now, when you're looking here, you know, at your character Key, and now that she's been in book two, you're kind of starting to get a good sense of her. And is that kind of the way that you're feeling, that you're kind of maybe starting to understand her a little bit more and a little bit more of how she's going to progress going forward now in your series?
Yeah, I mean, I think the second book in the series is kind of a bridge book in many ways. I mean, in the first book, it was all about the investigation and the chase. But since I have a series going, and I hope it will be a very long series, I have the luxury of letting readers into Key's head a little bit more. Now, she's my narrator. I write first person, so we're in Key's point of view all the time.
Right.
But, you know, when I know Key very well, it's really strange experience with her. I've never had it before or since with a character. She just kind of dropped in my lap one Thanksgiving night. I actually pulled over on I-75 and up in North Georgia and wrote the first lines for The Stranger You Seek. And as soon as I wrote them first person and heard that character's voice, I knew, first of all, that she was strong enough to carry a series, that she was strong enough to be my narrator, and I just felt like I knew everything about her. I understood her past. I knew I wanted to write someone with some demons that was a survivor and not a victim, someone with a sense of humor, and someone that kind of wrestles the addiction demon every day, and she still does. But she's been, you know, sober for 4 years now when we meet her.
And again, we're speaking here with author Amanda Kyle Williams, and her website is AmandaKyleWilliams.com. The second book in her Key Street series is called Stranger in the Room, and that's the book that is out now. And what people might also notice is when they read your biography, they're going to see that you've done a lot of different things. You've jumped around, you've done a lot of different things. And what that kind of given you, though, is it's given you a lot of different experiences to be able to write things about, to be able to pull things from house painting to property manager, you know, commercial embroiderer. I mean, you've done a lot of different things. Do you pull on those experiences from the things that you were able to see and view from, you know, doing different things?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, and I think we all do. But my editor says that writers use everything, that they use every experience, that they use every person they've ever met. And I think that's true for all of us. We're all kind of a compilation of our experiences. But as far as jobs, my bio really reads like a person that couldn't hold down a job. And that's probably true. I knew I wanted to be a writer when I grew up, a full-time writer. So I wasn't always looking for a career. I was mostly just trying to buy the groceries. But, you know, so many of those jobs informed my writing in a way that I never expected. I worked with a private detective firm in Atlanta, and I was also a profit server. So many of the jobs that Key's doing now, even though I write fiction around them, are jobs that I did. So, all those times when I was driving around Atlanta and doing my job and learning the city and looking at the city like a tourist and falling in love with it again and serving subpoenas and doing surveillance, I didn't really realize then how much of it I would use, but it was a fantastic foundation for writing a private detective.
Do you have a story that you can share that's just like so whacked out that people will be like, there's no way that that's true? Come on, Amanda,
well,
you know you got one. You can change the names to protect the guilty, but there's got to be something.
Well, I did. It's really funny when you're out, especially when you're out serving subpoenas. The ones that really bounce like a football, like you don't know, you know, which way they're going to bounce, or the like deadbeat dads or the restraining orders. So I used a couple of those stories in The Stranger You Seek. I did have to meet a man once at a church with his pastor present. He had been ordered to go to this church and have counseling sessions in order to ever be able to see his wife and child again, because he had been really abusive. And the reason I had to meet him there was because he was dangerous. They were afraid if I met him alone that he would do something horrible to me. So that was, I actually wrote fiction around that story and used it in The Stranger You Seek. It was terrifying. I was once chased down by a woman with a coffee cup.
Nice.
I just served her a subpoena in a box that said Sweepstakes Award Headquarters. And when she took it out and found her cup, there was a subpoena in it. And I had to get out of there pretty quick. So, you know, I've written fiction around all those stories. Of course, no one was slinging guns in my real life stories, but they definitely do in my books. So, he has to dodge some bullets.
And now, for your fans that is now following the Key Street series, what's the one thing about Key that they would be shocked to maybe know what she actually does, maybe when the pages are closed and she's sitting there alone at night with just her thoughts?
Ooh, that's a great question.
Well, I only ask great questions. I don't ask crappy ones.
That's right. I'm really impressed, John. I think it was really important to me, like I said, to not write a victim. He has a big sense of humor, and she deals with her addiction issues. She deals with everything with a lot of humor because she's a survivor and she refuses to be a victim. But I think when the book is closed and Key's alone at night, she's still dealing with what the kind of the residue of addiction, and that is that it just tears away at your self-esteem. You know, under all that, I think she tends to feel a little bit less than, and she has to make up for it. That's one of the dirty tricks of addiction, when you have to hide what's really going on in your life. I think maybe that's the thing. Maybe that comes out a little bit in the pages. But, you know, Key has to also wrestle down her own insecurities.
Now, again, we're speaking here with Amanda Kyle Williams, and the book is Stranger in the Room, second book in her Key Street series. And the other thing, too, is that I always find fascinating is when they go here to your site and they're going to see many different things, and, you know, you have events and stuff that are going on. One thing is that, you know, you support book clubs. And you're sitting there, and you're one of the authors who will literally go and call and be a conference call maybe to a book club for someone reading your book. How, you know, has that happened yet? Have you been able to sit there and discuss with a book club about your book, like on a conference call? And what are the kinds of things that they're interested in knowing when they get you, you know, one-on-one to be able to talk about the book?
This is one of my favorite things to do, John. I just love it. It puts you in the living room with a group of people who are passionate about books and words. So, I mean, that's pretty much every writer's dream. I've done several of them via conference call, via Skype. And here in Atlanta, I've shown up in person for several of them as well, which is great because they usually feed me and there's you and look, these people drink, they usually offer me wine or something. But it's really fun just to sit around and just be there for their regular monthly book club meeting, and they get to ask the author directly questions. Here in Atlanta, it's been really enjoyable because my series is set in Atlanta, and Atlanta is a huge character in the book. So it kind of creeps them out when they're reading about murder and stuff on their street. So that's been really fun. And you know, they generally people want to know about the process and you know how Key was born, why I'm writing a Chinese American who was raised by white Southern parents. So those are typically the questions I get. But these book clubs are so, I mean, they're invaluable. You know, we know that there's at least, I think, registered with like Book Movement and places like that, there's 5.2 million people in book clubs, and those are just the ones we know about. So, I mean, this is, you know, to build this kind of support, it builds kind of grassroots support. And these people, the local book clubs, when I have local events, show up to support me. So they're now partnering in my career. So it's huge. It's great for an author and plus, you have a chance to get into a reader's head a little bit, what they liked, what they didn't like, what worked for them, what didn't work, et cetera.
You know, and do you ever find that maybe someone, you know, is talking? Because here's the funniest thing that I always crack up on, and I'm going to just say it. I find English teachers absolutely annoying to the fact of that they feel that their opinion is correct, and when they ask you, well, this, what did you feel of the book, or what did you get out of it, and things like that, and then you write your opinion because that's what you truly say, and they said, well, no, that's not right, that's not what the author meant, and I'm like, well, how the hell do you know, because you didn't ask the author. So do you kind of find, you know, those kinds of things where people might mistaking maybe some underlining meanings that you have kind of written in your book, and you're like, no, that's really not what I meant, or something like that?
You know, I have not. I've been very lucky, and I can say that that everyone that I've had the pleasure of talking to and meeting with has just been really accepting and fantastic, and have loved the books. I did encounter a civil lawyer at one of the meetings who had some issue, and I can't quite remember what it was, with something in my books that she didn't feel like was, or I think she felt I had stretched the law a bit. So, but you know, readers are very, you have
well,
to do your homework.
Well, it's fiction, isn't it? I mean, isn't that the whole idea? You can stretch things because it's fiction.
Yeah, but readers are very sophisticated. I mean, they understand that you're writing fiction, but they want it to be authentic. And I understand this, and in fact, and they get very specific. He is now translated into several languages, the Stranger series is, and I got a note from a Dutch reader the other day that said he had, you know, taken a ride down Peachtree Street through Atlanta via Google Maps and followed a route in the book that Key had driven, and he was congratulating me on getting it right. Now, I live here in the city, but readers, they want you to get it right. They understand you're writing fiction, but they want to feel like they're going to school a little bit too, that they're learning something about law enforcement, that they're learning something about private detectives, that they're learning something about the city. So it's important to put them there correctly.
And a lot of people, again, we're speaking with Amanda Kyle Williams, and they can see you now at VoucherCon, which is literally just around the corner. I believe it's next weekend. Is this your first VoucherCon? Have you been to them before?
I have. I was there last year when my first book was released, and really looking forward to it this year because The Stranger You Seek is a finalist for Best New. Best first PI novel for a Seamus
Award.
Thank you very much. So I'll be at the Seamus ceremony on next Friday night in Cleveland. I believe it's on the Queen Nautica. We'll be cruising on Lake Erie while we're doing the ceremony. So I'm really excited about that. I have a panel on Saturday. I'm excited about the conference. This is always fun for me. Again, you know, fan-based conferences are a great opportunity for you to meet readers. And there's just, it's like being in a bookstore and meeting people. There's nothing like it. Hopefully you can connect. Hopefully they'll want to support your career going forward.
Yeah, and that's always important. And these conferences today are even more important, seeing as how the social media and everything is taking over. It's almost a little more rare now to be able to meet authors, not just with bookstores closing, but the idea of, you know, people doing blog tours and radio tours like this. You don't have to get out of your house as much to go meet with the author. So the opportunity that you're there to go maybe to like Thriller Fest or VoucherCon and those kinds of events are very important. That this is, you know, a lot of opportunities to sit down, have a drink with the author, you know, talk with you, and things like that.
That's absolutely right. I couldn't agree more. And by the way, you can almost always find the authors in the bar.
Always, always. Go, I'm telling everybody, if you want to find an author, just sit at the bar. You will see every single author that you will ever want to meet at the bar. They'll all be there at one time or another.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, I mean, and especially, and I'm sure that Lee Child is doing his Reacher Party, which is a fabulous event where he kind of goes and everybody kind of goes to the bar and he just kind of takes care of it, and it's just like the little Reacher Party, and that's always fun to go to. And I believe it's Saturday nights that he does that, or Friday nights, one of the two.
Yeah, I hope it's not Friday night because I'll miss it, but I'm a huge Lee Child fan. Of course, we share an editor at Bantam, and I'm crazy about the guy, just a really sweet, laid-back guy, and, of course, you know, who isn't a Reacher fan? So.
Yeah, and then with the movie coming out and everything else, there'll be a lot of excitement around that. So.
Yeah, lucky him. Way to go, Lee.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of talk about Tom Cruise, whatever, blah, 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 blah. But if the fans don't like Tom Cruise, you know, they're not going to – first of all, the fans never like anything anyway when it comes to the screen. They're always very fickle. And
yes.
Whoever it is, they're going to complain. But what it will do is if they do the movie correctly, even if it's Tom Cruise or not, people that don't know Lee Child might now be interested to pick up the Reacher series, and that's kind of what it's about anyway when you're making, you know, the movie. It's about – attracting more fans to your work with the way that, you know, he can now reach millions of people that way.
Yeah, and he's already reaching a ton of people, but that really happens in this country. Book sales go off the charts when
yeah.
a television series is spun off or a movie from a book series.
Yeah, well, Amanda, in the future, I'm sure that we'll have that conversation with you when your book decides to be made into a movie or TV show. And we want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing with us a little bit about Strange in the Room and Key Street.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been really fun.
Yes, and we will talk with you later, and so just keep us up to date on what's going on.
I sure will. Thanks so much, John.
All right, bye-bye. So again, everybody, that is Amanda Kyle Williams with her book, Stranger in the Room, second book in the Key Street series. Perfect, it says, for fans of Karen Slaughter and Patricia Cornwell, fast-paced books that are sure to make sure that, you know, sure to please. Well, I'll tell you what, it has been such an amazing show. I just want to thank all of the guests that we have on, starting back with James Houston Turner, Sarah Kernikan, and Amanda Kyle Williams now. We will be on the air next weekend. I'm not sure who's on, but I guess I could find out real fast for you. We're going to be on here next weekend with Amy Sogel, Keith Romeo, and David Lyons are going to be joining us. So that'll be a great show. Coming up on August 20th, though, very special announcement I have coming up because August 20th is going to be a very exciting show. Not only are we going to have John Connolly and Sandra Pershall, we're going to welcome back again Tasha Alexander. She's always a great favorite, and Sam Hawken. But John Connolly and Tasha Alexander are doing something for the fans only here on our show. Nowhere else. You're not going to hear it because it's going to be right here. You can only hear it here. I'm going to say it again. You can only hear it here. I'm trying to get ratings. That's what I'm trying to do. This is like a ratings thing. So John Connolly and Tasha Alexander are going to be signing autographed copy of their book and sending it out to a listener of this show. When you listen to the October 20th show, we're going to have a contest for John Connolly and Tasha Alexander's autographed book to you. And all you have to do is simply listen, answer a question, send us an email. You're going to be in the drawing to win the book. We're going to let it go on here for a couple weeks because we know a lot of people listen to the show archive. So that's something to keep in mind. And anybody can join. I mean, if Tasha wants to join her own show, I guess she could if she really wanted to. But that's something that's coming up. Again, our October issue is going to be out shortly. If you don't have a copy, you're not on the list to get your four free issues, email us at editor@suspensemagazine.com for that, and we'll be sure that you'll get your four free issues. Exciting. Great. John Stanford's going to be in the October issue, along with a lot of other great stuff. So, again, we'll see you all next week. Check us out, suspensemagazine.com, here on Blog Talk Radio. It's been a pleasure. I'm done talking. I don't know how they do it for 4 hours because I am pushed. See you later.